Okay, Boker Tov, everyone. So we'll continue this morning with our learning, trying to add a little dimension that we had done last week. So last week we focused on a particular individual from the 20th century, and today I wanted to focus on a little bit of Torah from the 19th century. And really, to do this properly, I'm not the right person, because you have to be, in a certain sense, you have to be both a great giant Torah scholar and also, or alternatively, also a prodigious Jewish historian, of which I am neither. So we're going to kind of do a little bit of a disservice, but we'll try to reference some of the places to look if you were to be interested in this. And that is a piece of Torah on this week's parasha, the introduction to Sefer Shmos, authored by Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, he was born, most say, in 1816, although maybe 1817, a little discussion. His father was a business person and a well-known Talmud Chacham in a city known as Mir. And
it's the same Mir as him as the Mir, right?
So, at the age of 13 and a half, he was already chosen by a brilliant giant in Torah, Reb Itzel of Volozhiner, who we'll talk about in a little bit, as his son-in-law. So he was known as a brilliant Talmud Chacham already from his young years. He spent his time as an incredible masmid. And then, in 1851, Rabbi Itzel of Volozhiner passed away. He was succeeded by one of his other sons-in-law, and then in 1854, he was succeeded as the Rosh Yeshiva of a very important yeshiva in 1854, and that is the Volozhin Yeshiva. So part of the background of the works of the Netziv is his personal struggles, his personal growth. Part of it is the story of the Volozhin Yeshiva. Part of it is the story of the context of what was happening in that time, and part of it is just the amazing Torah that he shared. He published many works. So part of this presentation, and we'll just give you some of the rough outlines, I don't know if this appears anywhere in English. There was a man who fulfills both of the criteria that I outlined earlier, both a brilliant Talmud Chacham and a prodigious historian, and his name was Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Rav Zevin was exactly that. He wrote many volumes in terms of editing and halachic works. He was the chief editor of the Encyclopedia Talmudit before he passed away, the Talmud Encyclopedia. He also wrote newspaper columns and Sipurei Hasidim. He himself was, I think, connected with Chabad. He lived in Yerushalayim, I believe. And he wrote a book, which I have a couple of pages of here, called Ishim Veshitos, Men and Their Approaches. Meaning, great rabbinic figures in the last 200 years, and what their unique approach to Jewish learning was, what they brought to the table, what was special about them, what they innovated. And the first of his essays is about the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin of Volozhin. So that's one place to look. Another place to look for biographical information, if you look on the inside of the cover, you will see the Sharblat, the opening page, of the Sefer called Makor Baruch. Makor Baruch, you see what it says? Me'iti, from me, I wrote this. Who is it? Baruch Halevi Epstein, me Pinsk. Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein of Pinsk was the author of a work known as the Torah Tamima, the commentary on the Chumash called the Torah Tamima. So he himself was a prominent Talmud Chacham. He learned in Volozhin, I believe it was 1873 till 1878. And, most importantly for this discussion, the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was his uncle and his brother-in-law.
Right.
His uncle and his brother-in-law. The Netziv's second wife, right, was his niece. I guess. So the Netziv's second wife was his niece. So when he refers to the to the Netziv, he usually refers to him as Dodi, my uncle, but also refers to him as Gisi, my brother-in-law. So this is one place. The Makor Baruch is four volumes. The entire fourth volume is devoted to the life of the Netziv. I did not go through the whole fourth volume of the Makor Baruch, but if you really want to know the full life of the Netziv, that's a good place to look. However, if you look on the next page, there's another book, which I did not go through the whole thing, but I'm giving you a little reference here, by Rabbi Dr. Gil Pearl, now in Philadelphia, formerly of Memphis, called The Pillar of Voloshin. And it's a scholarly work about the Netziv as the Rosh Hashiva of Voloshin, but also the development of the learning of the Netziv and the influence of the style of learning that was going on in Voloshin because of the Netziv's upbringing and his intellectual upbringing, specifically focusing on the earliest work of the Netziv called Emek HaNetziv, which was a commentary of the Netziv on the Sifri. So what I gave you on this page, on page 2, is the footnote 48 here, where he summarizes, because he's a good person to know, he summarizes the different biographical works that you can find on the Netziv. So if you happen to be interested in this, take a look in the footnote here, and he gives you a whole list of the biographies, including, on the sixth line, Avraham Yitzchak Kook, Tzvi Letzadik. So Rav Kook actually wrote a small biography, a small appreciation of the Netziv. Why would Rav Kook write an appreciation of the Netziv? Any guesses?
Because he was a Zionist.
Okay, he was a Zionist. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Berlin was one of the members of the Chibas Zion movement, the Zionist movement. But it's because Rav Kook was a student of the Netziv. Rav Kook was a student in Voloshin when the Netziv was the Rosh Hashiva.
When was he the Rosh Hashiva again?
I'll get that in a second. From 1854 till 1892 when the Yeshiva closed.
Okay.
So Rav Kook was a close disciple, and there are legends say that Rav Kook was actually the Purim Rav. He used to do a Purim spiel and imitate the Netziv on Purim. So he also wrote an appreciation of the Netziv. There's a lot, that's what he points out here, there's a lot in the footnote that is written about the Netziv. So the Netziv was born in 1817 in Mir. In 1831, he married the daughter of Reb Itzel of Voloshiner. There was a great Gaon who lived in Lithuania in the end of the 18th century. His name was the Vilna Gaon, Rav Eliyahu of Vilna. So Rav Eliyahu of Vilna was a revolutionary, titanic figure in the Jewish world. He was very much opposed to Hasidus, and he had a chief student, a chief disciple. His name was Rav Chaim, who became known as Rav Chaim Voloshiner. And in 1803, Rav Chaim Voloshiner founded a yeshiva. The yeshiva was called Eitz Chaim. This was the prototype. It wasn't the only, but it was the major Lithuanian yeshiva in the 19th century. So Reb Itzel Voloshiner, son-in-law, was the Netziv, and the Netziv became the Rosh Yeshiva in 1854. The Netziv himself was an unbelievable masmid. He describes in Baruch Halevi Epstein's Makor Baruch, that the Netziv says that when he told him, the Netziv was his uncle. So they used to travel together, used to talk together when he was in Voloshin, he looked after him. He said that when he was younger, some of the other, Talmidei Chachamim didn't really pay too much attention to him. He was kind of a loner because he said he wasn't so successful. He wasn't the brightest in the bunch. But it was known that the Netziv was an unbelievably incredible masmid. He was incredibly diligent, to the point where Baruch Halevi Epstein records that people said that he would put his feet in ice water when he felt like he was getting tired so he wouldn't distract himself from learning. So he wouldn't have to fall asleep. He would keep himself up with ice water. That's diligence for you. The Netziv was known to be very diligent, and that kind of was the style of learning, the incredible diligence. That was the style of learning in Voloshin Yeshiva. So you kind of on the one hand, you talk about the biography of the Netziv. On the other hand, you talk about the biography of the Voloshin Yeshiva, because the two of them are very inextricably linked, because he was the primary Rosh Yeshiva from 1854 until the Yeshiva closed in 1892.
Where was
Geographically, where were they located?
Volozhin is a town?
Volozhin is a small town in Lithuania, not far from Vilna and Kovno. Oh. So if, I don't have my computer here, but you could do like a Google search. And you could see the Volozhin Yeshiva building, I believe. I've never been to Eastern Europe, but it's just not, as a Kohen, it's just not one of the top places I'm going to go. But people say that the Volozhin Yeshiva building is still there.
Is it near Warsaw?
Warsaw's Poland.
No, Warsaw is in Poland. This is much further north and east.
It's Lithuania.
In Lithuania. So it wasn't the only yeshiva, but it was one of the few yeshivas. And just like the Netziv himself was an unbelievable masmid, there was a tremendous emphasis on hasmada in the yeshiva. The Netziv published, first when he was young, he published a unique work, which was not common necessarily in rabbinic figures. And part of what Rav Zevin develops is how the Netziv used to look back at original sources, very many original sources, earlier sources that weren't necessarily studied, and that helped shape the way that he would learn in general and the way that his whole world of learning was shaped. So one of the first things he published, is something called Emek HaNetziv, which is the basis of the focus of Gil Pearl's book, which was a commentary on the Sifri. The Sifri is a halachic medrash. So we're used to thinking about halacha developing through the Gemara, which is true. The primary mode of development is through the Gemara, and that is primarily through the Talmud Bavli, through the Babylonian Talmud. But there is also the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Palestinian, the Jerusalem Talmud, and there is a wealth of homilies, so to speak, but they're not exactly homilies, right? In the days of the Talmud, so you're talking 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, and basically you're rounding out there in the 5th century with Ravina Ravashi, the Talmudic period of time, the rabbis were not just studying and teaching and creating the Talmud, analyzing the Mishnah, they were also delivering homilies and studying and teaching based on the Chumash. And those break into two categories. There is what we call Medrash Agada, homiletic Medrash, so that's probably what we're most familiar with. Some of them are fables that are trying to teach you a lesson, some of them are biblical exegesis, some of them are using tools like, we call them modern literary devices, but the rabbis use them all the time in their study of Medrash and their use of Medrash. Let's say comparing similar phrases. Not allegory, but let's say intertextuality. You know, you have a phrase that appears here in the Chumash, you have a phrase that appears here in Megillas Esther, and you put the two together. And you say, you know, where does this lead us? What's the connection? What's it trying to tell us? That's Medrash Agada. Then there's a whole other world of Medrash. That's called Medrash Halacha, where it's not organized by tractate, it's organized by Perek and Pasuk, where you go line by line, let's say the Mechilta, which is a Medrash on Sefer Shemos, so you want to learn the laws of Korban Pesach, so you open up to the section of Korban Pesach in the Torah, and you'll find in the Mechilta, you'll find all the laws of Korban Pesach with the derivatives. It's kind of like a Talmudic work based on the Chumash. Similar style, well, not same, similar style, but similar idea that you're teaching the laws, and sometimes you're coming up with the derivation of the laws based on the verses, but it's not organized in kind of a back-and-forth style. There are arguments, but it's a much more terse halachic work. And the Netziv makes this the subject of his first work, which is very unusual. Traditionally, if you want to focus on halacha, so you just learn the Gemara, but the Netziv expands this, and it's not surprising that that influences, says Rabbi Dr. Pearl, that influences his later work. Now, he's, of course, not the first one to use the Medrash Halacha. The Rambam, actually, very often bases his writings and his rulings in the Mishneh Torah not necessarily on the Gemara that we use, the Gemara Talmud Bavli. Sometimes it's on the Yerushalmi, and very often it's on the Sifri, and that's what the commentators on the side point out sometimes, that it's not based on the Talmud, it's based on the Medrash Halacha. So the Netziv's first work was on the Medrash Halacha. Then his second work was on another very obscure work, and that became like, that is the text that's used today, something, a work called the She'iltos of Rav Acha Gaon. But the period of the Gaonim was sandwiched between the Talmud and the Savoraim and the period of the Rishonim. So let's say, you know, give or take from the 7th century until the 11th century or the 10th century, so you had great scholars who were called Gaonim. Why were they called Gaonim? Because, well, part of it is because they were genius, but actually the reason it was called was because the yeshiva in Bava was called Gaon Yaakov. And if you were the Rosh Yeshiva, you were known as the Gaon. That's why they were called Gaonim. Happens to be that not every historians say that not every person who was a Gaon, who was the head of Gaon Yaakov, was such a Gaon, was the greatest. So that's why they had different, you know, different ones carry different weight. So one of the great, most prestigious, so you had certain certain Gaonim who were very prestigious. One of them was Rav Acha Gaon, who wrote a kind of like a merger between responsa and a Chumash commentary. What is that? He has a series of responsa and he organizes them based on the parsha. So somehow each responsa fits into the parsha somewhere. Oh, you have a halachic question. He develops the answer and it's under the framework of the parshios. It's a very unique work. This she'iltos, the word she'iltos means Shilas, questions. But it's Shilas organized according to the parsha. And it's written, what year was it written? I don't know, 8th century, 9th century. And it had not really been studied. And the Netziv writes a massive commentary. And today, the classic edition of the She'iltos, Rav Achoy, these questions, includes the comments of the Ha'amek She'ela, the in-depth, the Emek. We had Emek, the depth of the Emek, what was the first one? Emek HaNetziv, and now we have He'emek She'ela, the depth of the question. The question means the She'iltos Rav Achoy. Again, a very important primary source from the Gaonim, but not necessarily studied by others. And then later in his life, in 1879-1880, we have the appearance of his major work called He'emek Davar. That's what we're going to focus on this morning a little bit, the learning of the depth of the Chumash, which has two sections in it, the Hemek Dover, which is the bottom commentary, and then on the bottom of that is like a secondary, more expanding commentary called Harchev Dover, the expansion of the thing. So it's Hemek HaNetziv, Hemek She'ela, and then Hemek Dover. Then he also wrote responsa. Some of them were published posthumously called Meshiv Dover. So the Netziv was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, an unbelievable Gaon, and his in-depth hasmada enabled him to reach, and his style reach, a unique perspective. And that's what Rav Zevin develops in his approach. So the Volozhin Yeshiva was shaped largely by the influence of the Netziv. The Netziv, we just mentioned that what we're going to learn today is the piece from the Hamek Davar. The Netziv gave a Chumash shir in the Volozhin Yeshiva every morning after davening, which is also unique to think about that. On the one hand, the Volozhin Yeshiva, based on the Vilna Gaon's model, even though the Vilna Gaon was knowledgeable in math and music and other things, the yeshiva was very much Torah only. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the Netziv included every day a study of Chumash. The schedule in the yeshiva was Shachris was 8 o'clock in the morning, followed by breakfast and then Chumash. First Seder was from 10 o'clock in the morning until 1 o'clock. And then they had a shir, and we'll talk about a little bit who gave those shirim. Then they had 4 o'clock was mincha, and then learning until 10 o'clock. Then you had dinner at 10 o'clock, and then many would return and still study until midnight, and then they would sleep until 3, and then get up at 3 to have morning Seder, Seder. Morning Marav was 10 o'clock.
What time was dinner?
Dinner was about 10:15.
Okay. And
it was well known that it was customary in the yeshiva of Volozhin that there was learning all night. There was not a second that was existent in the yeshiva of Volozhin that didn't have learning. They took kind of turns. Now this was a very austere and rigorous type of existence. And one of the very well-known pupils of the Volozhin yeshiva was a man by the name of Chaim Nachman Bialik. Mm-hmm. So if you look on page 3, you have a poem. This is only a small section of the long poem by Bialik called Hamasmid. And it's a perspective on a Masmid. He doesn't name the name of the yeshiva that he's describing, of this boy who shuts himself away for several years. And it's kind of like a mixed picture. On the one hand, he has an appreciation and a respect for those students who essentially went away from home for months and sometimes years on end and lived in people's homes under the harshest, sometimes impoverished conditions. On the other hand, he's talking about the disconnect that it has from the outside world and the narrowness and the challenge of it. And as part of this paragraph, Hamasmid, he describes the Rosh Yeshiva of the yeshiva. Who is the Rosh Yeshiva that he's describing? We know who that is. That's the Netziv. And he describes if it's got printed left to right for some reason. So if you go to the left side, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines up from the bottom, Hurosh Hayeshiva Adirah Umoshla, Shekriyas Hagevra Kol Masmid Harishon Mikima Mitsua Gviaso Hakoshla. He's describing how the Rosh Hashiva is listening for the first boy who's learning in the morning. Vishamo, top of the next column, Beis, Kol Masmin Ba'ora Hashachu, Oiv Lahakshi Rav Kesha Bidmama. So how the Rosh Hashiva is listening carefully. It's almost like the attentiveness that he's paying attention to. And Rav Baruch Halevi describes how the Nitziv was extremely attentive to all the boys in the yeshiva, finding out about each one. And and Bialik describes how two tears roll down the Sa'ar Kesef, the silver hair and the white beard of the Rosh Hashiva, as he remembers the chain of old and his young years listening to the Masmid, learning in the Beis Medrash. And he describes further. So this is kind of like the world of the Beis Medrash, the world of the Nitziv in its intensity. However, it was not easy. The Nitziv was actively involved in fundraising because they had small stipends for the impoverished yeshiva bachurim who were learning in Volozhin. In the beginning, only had several scores of students. Under the tutelage of the Nitziv, there were hundreds of students who were learning in the Volozhin yeshiva. Now this is fascinating. Source number 4. This comes from this volume, called Shnos Dor Vador. There was someone who made a collection, an interesting collection of primary documents. He's a historical collector of letters and all kinds of documents that were published in this beautiful volume. It was published by Art Scroll. It was a personal collection of someone who wanted to share it with others. So one of the collections that he has here is a series of letters to a professor, Avraham Harkavi. Harkavi was a professor in St. Petersburg who had learned in his youth in Volozhin. So he collects several letters to Harkavi, and who is the author of some of these letters? The Nitziv, who he probably knew, remember this young boy. And this letter that you have on pages 4, 5, and 6, you see the handwriting. I give it to you because I wanted you to see the handwriting of the Nitziv. But also because, so you see the handwriting? If you look on the top, you look on page 5, Gimel Chof Hei Shvat Tav Shin Mem Aleph. So that means it was Tav Shin Mem Aleph is 18. Oh, I did this conversion yesterday, but I didn't write down the number. It's 5641, and now we're in 5776. So it's 135 years ago. So that's going to be 1881. Yes? Paul, math?
Sounds about right.
Sounds about right? So it's the fall 1881.
And another 20 years.
Right, so 1881. Good, okay. So you see the handwriting in the Nitziv. This is authored in 1881. And it's to the Chacham, the Sofer. Who is it? Professor Rab Avram Harkavi. That's the top of the... And on the bottom, what they do in this volume is they give you the translation of the letter and the printed section on the bottom. What do we find here? The Nitziv is asking Harkavi to help him. Help him what? Help him in a struggle. The yeshiva is facing a struggle. And what's that?
Money.
This is described, partly it's money, but if you look on page 8, we'll come back to this in a second. So there is about a 50-page article that's published. I should have written this down. This is in the second Torah Umada journal. So I went through this whole article, not every footnote, but I went through the whole article by Rabbi J.J. Schachter. Rabbi Schachter happens to be a teacher of mine. I was in New York this week meeting new fellows for next year. I had the opportunity to spend a half hour with Rabbi Schachter. He's an unbelievable historian, as many of you know. Great rabbi, unbelievable person. So he's invested in me a lot in me over the years. So he has an article that was published in the second edition of the Torah Mada Journal called Haskalah, Secular Studies, and the Close of the Yeshiva in Volozhin. You can get this online if this is something that interests you. You can get this online. And he describes the development of the Volozhin Yeshiva in terms of its struggle with the Haskalah. By the middle of the 19th century, the Haskalah, the Enlightenment movement, strengthened, and by 1855, with I think it was Tsar Alexander II, there was a strong movement towards
1855.
Yeah, there was a strong movement toward this burgeoning culture of non-religious enlightenment in the Jewish community. And that brought with it, it's much slower, it's much far behind the Enlightenment in, let's say, Germany and Western Europe, because they hadn't quite reached the Russian communities. But now, by the middle of the 19th century, with a more open czar to these kinds of ideas, and finally the ideas reaching there, so now you have tremendous pressure, and the creation of academic journals and many popular figures, writers and thinkers and philosophers. So now there's a huge, as the second half of the century moves on, there's a huge pressure to expand the Enlightenment to all corners of the Jewish educational system. And who is kind of chief among the antagonists, the kind of the opposition of the Enlightenment? That is the yeshiva world. And Volozhin, as the crown jewel of the yeshiva world — there weren't that many yeshivas in general — but Volozhin represents the austerity, the antithesis of the maskilim. So very often, Rabbi Schachter chronicles this, and this is what's interesting about this letter, going back to page 4. The Netziv is asking Professor Harkavi, he says, we have to figure out what to do here, because the yeshiva is getting slammed in these journals, in these maskilish journals, in these various periodicals that are criticizing the yeshiva of all different aspects. And he describes in this letter the criticisms that he's feeling, that he's hearing from these journals. Now, the Netziv also was wont to write in these journals for fundraising purposes. And then they took out advertisements to support the yeshiva. So it was kind of like a tumultuous back and forth. But he describes how they are shaming the yeshiva. Take a look on the first, on page 4, in the bottom, in the printed section. The line starts, Bevoi es ma'alos kvodo nero ya'ir. Hineni lo suach moras ruchi, I'm so bitter. Ulai yirvachli, ulai, maybe you'll help me. It's, next line starts with the word ulai. Ki cherpa shavra libi b'ra'osi b'melitz. I saw in the journal Melitz. Divrei echad mikiov. That what? Asher nesanunu leforei musar uskulas ha'yeshiva ha'kadosh legidufim. They're speaking heresy about our yeshiva. Next page. They're speaking about the conditions in the yeshiva. They say, you know what they say, that we only use dirty lamps, that there's no proper lighting, so that it's dirty for the bachrim. And on the Sidrei HaLimud, third line, Va'al Dvar Sidrei HaLimud, Lo La'adam Kazel Havin Ma'u Pilpul Shal Hevel, Ma'u Pilpul Shal Eino Shal Hevel. He says, you know what they're making fun of? How we learn. With our dialectic analytical study of Limud, our study, they say, it's a waste of time. They call it, says the Netziv, Pilpul HaSev. He says, he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand the style and the academic rigor, the nature of the learning in our yeshiva. Following in the footsteps of Rav Chaim Volozhin, or going to page 6. And look, not only that, we've produced rabbis. They say we need to teach Russian in our yeshiva so that we can have educated people. He says, we have the Rav Zev Vial on page 6, Rav Bekilas Kiov. Wait a minute, the rabbi of your community studied in Volozhin. So, you know, what's your problem? And then he goes over to page 7. He says, you think you know what's best for the rabbis? How do you know what's best for the rabbis? What's the whole issue here? Whether or not they should introduce the Haskalah, they should introduce secular studies into the learning of the yeshiva. Now, what Rabbi Schachter discusses is, was the Netziv himself opposed to secular studies? No. The Nitziv himself used to read the newspaper regularly before anybody else got to it. One of the family members describes that apparently the mail used to come twice a week to Volozhin. That was it. So when it came with a pile of newspapers, and he was always careful to read it. And the Nitziv describes kind of his attitude toward this in a tshuva. This tshuva is on page 9. We'll get to the piece from the Hamikdavar, don't worry, I haven't forgotten about it. But this helps us not only appreciate the Nitziv, now we can get to some of the Nitziv's own writings, A, the letter, and B, this tshuva. Fascinating tshuva. This is on page 9. This is from the Shailos HaTshuvos Meishiv Davar Chelek Aleph Simen Mem Dalet. What is the title of the tshuva? Al Yamin Usmol. On the right and the left. So it's a fascinating inclusion that they included this in a halachic response to work. Ra'isi Ba'ale Marzike Hadas Gilyon Gimel. I found there is a Torah journal called Marzike Hadas. Hanikra ha-ma'amar b'shem yaminu smol. And they wanted to find out in the Torah whether or not, and they wanted, and I wanted to suggest my opinion. Next paragraph. Hein erichu loshan ha-chakira hayuchal das Yisrael lehechalek l'shlosha gzarim. Hanimtza yaminu smol ve'emtza b'mahalach emunoseinu. Does Judaism have a right wing and a left wing and a center? Is there such a thing in Judaism? Or is it really just one way? It's a fascinating question. So the Nitziv answers, and he says, yes, there is a right wing and a left wing. Now, he says, this is what he thinks that it is. On the next page, he describes that the right wing, maiminim, that means those who are very dovuk, they are involved in dveikus of avas Hashem, on a high spiritual level, to the exclusion, essentially, he says, of interacting with others, even teaching others. He says, they're completely removed from that. He says, the masme'ilim, those are the people, they are absolutely 100% observant, but they're much more philosophical in their approach. They are 100% religious, but they're not as inclined in their spiritual quest toward dveikus. Rather, they are involved in a more philosophical, and they're involved in teaching others about godliness. And then there is the kind of the middle of the road people who, when they're involved in davening or learning, are extremely spiritually inclined. But when they're not involved in davening and learning, they're much more academic or intellectually inclined. That's how the Nitziv describes the right wing, in his view, the left wing, and the centrist kind of perspectives in Judaism, which is a very interesting way that he views the breakdown of the three groups. But then, go to the next page on page 11, he quotes, he says, "Hamarich horu v'hogu eitzel lios nishmar midor zeh." We have a problem today, he says, we're facing the challenge of the Haskalah. Now in Volozhin, the Volozhin yeshiva had forbidden any Haskalah, any secular studies. They forbade any Zionist activities. Everything was focused on one single goal, and that was Torah, learning, and Torah only. So the Nitziv says, what do we do today? We're facing the Haskalah. So he quotes from this pamphlet, this edit essay, who says, you know what we should do? Hine amar chog, you know what they said? Li parid zemi zel legamri, kamo shenifrad Avraham milot. Says, you know what we should do, how we should deal with these non-observant maskilim? The author of this work, Marzik Adas, says, you know what, we should separate from them. Stay away from them. Completely separate ourselves, just like Avram separated from Lot. And then Tziv says, you know what? It's not going to work. Can't be. He says, even from the non-Jews, we haven't succeeded to separate ourselves. So how are we going to create a Torah community that's being inundated by Haskalah? So go to the next page. Page 12 on the bottom. Mikol ze lamadu lefaneinu marzike hadas. We know what we need to do. She'aleinu lehischazik lachzog b'torah. We need to strengthen ourselves in Torah learning. V'yisasku b'zehar harav v'roshi hakeila. She'yu hamalamdim gedolei Torah. And we need to create leaders who are themselves giants in Torah. And now listen to this next very interesting line. Vagam im yitzdarchu al pi hamalchus, lilmod limudei chol, even if we are coerced by the government to teach secular studies, which was, of course, a reference to the push by the Maskilim to introduce secular Russian studies into all Jewish educational institutions. Gam Kain, top of the next page, 13. Yehei, it should be, Bahashgacha meharav roshi Yisrael shiye hamore yirei Elokim. It should be not dangerous, so to speak, not heretical. It shouldn't be damaging secular studies. Says, what happens otherwise? If you're not supervised and integrated in the proper way, so kids who want to get secular studies, if it's going to be completely shut away from them, what are they going to do? They're going to run away and find secular studies on their own. Therefore, he says, you have to find this right balance. If you're going to have secular studies in these institutions, it has to be supervised, it has to be appropriate. And now, he adds, V'gam yu mefanim sha'os meruvachim la'esek ha'torah v'zeh v'zeh yiskayim b'yadam ha'af, and this is a key line, she'en l'kavel she'etzi milumudam b'sho'os ke'ila l'ho'ra. They won't use this time they're using for secular studies, they won't use it for becoming prominent rabbis. I'm on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines down. Ba'asher zedarka shel Torah. This is the way of Torah. She'en amala v'tachlisa miskayim ela b'mi b'yimei shemafana. It probably should be b'mi shemafana kol roshu b'zeh. You have, the only way to become a gadol b'Torah is to do one thing. It's to be only involved in learning. Ah, what about the Gedolei Torah who knew other subjects, himself included? He says, these great rabbinic figures became knowledgeable in secular learning either before they spent an intensive period in their yeshiva studies, or after they immersed themselves, then they went to spend time learning. So the Nitziv points out here something very subtle, but it's very important. You want to understand the Nitziv's worldview of the yeshiva and the Volozhin yeshiva, is that to become a great Torah scholar, to become a Torah giant, it needs to be only learning. For this reason, in the Volozhin yeshiva, he wanted to create great Torah giants, and therefore it was only learning. But it's not to say that the Nitziv didn't see any value in secular studies at all. And at the end, Rabbi Shakta points out in the article, the Nitziv was forced to include some measure of secular studies. It was taking place in a separate building, and it was only in specific hours, and specific students participated. But the Nitziv understood that there was some question of how it had to be navigated. Now, ultimately, in 1892, the Nitziv had to close the yeshiva. Why did he have to close the yeshiva? Because there was a new program that was instituted by the Russian government that instituted the overwhelming majority of the time was going to be spent studying secular studies. And Nitziv said, based on this, Mali Ulitzarazu, what do I need this for? That's not a yeshiva, that's a secular institution. The Nitziv did not have an easy time even being the Rosh Yeshiva. In addition to being the fundraiser, he also had internal challenges. A, you had, of course, Maskilim, like Bialik, who later left the yeshiva and was a famous Hebrew writer and poet. But then Nitziv also, when he became the Rosh Yeshiva, there was a whole dispute as to whether or not he should be the Rosh Yeshiva or the Beis HaLevi. Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik should be the Rosh Yeshiva. It was determined that the Nitziv should be the senior Rosh Yeshiva and the Beis HaLevi should be this second in command, but that was the whole based on a Din Torah. Rabbis had to come in to decide that. And then at the end of the Nitziv life, he appointed his son, Rav Chaim Berlin. Chaim Berlin, that name sounds familiar to us. Right? So Rav Chaim Berlin, he was the namesake from the yeshiva in New York, which I believe, if I'm not mistaken, was also called Eitz Chaim before it was renamed Yeshiva Sarbino Chaim Berlin, if I'm not mistaken, just like YU was called Eitz Chaim before it was renamed after the death of the Kovner Rav of Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Why were these yeshivas called Eitz Chaim? Because which was the yeshiva that was first called Eitz Chaim? Volozhin. So if you were going to transplant a yeshiva in New York, you wanted it to be the Volozhin Yeshiva. So when the Nitziv was advanced age and he was going to retire, he appointed his son Rav Chaim Berlin as the Rosh Yeshiva, but there was a huge group of students who battled him because they wanted Reb Chaim Soloveitchik to be the Rosh Yeshiva. So this too became a tremendous fight in the yeshiva. So it became a big question, who should be the Rosh Yeshiva? Anyway, so then at the end of his life...
Here's the son of Yosef Soloveitchik.
Yes.
So why did he go with his father today?
So the Beis HaLevi was for a while in Volozh, and then he left to become the Rav in Brisk. But Reb Chaim was there in the yeshiva teaching shiurim. He was one of the Magidei Shir in Volozhin.
While his father's in Brisk.
I think his father had passed away by then already. It could be. I don't remember exactly.
But there, why did he go with his father in Brisk? It seems like...
No, his father didn't have a yeshiva in Brisk. Oh. I don't think. His father was the Rav, the rabbi of Brisk. The yeshiva was in Volozhin. He may have had a small yeshiva, but it wasn't anything major. And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was now, and then it became a big fight. Who should succeed the Netziv? So finally, at the end, the Netziv had to close the yeshiva. And he wanted to go to Israel. He was a very big Zionist, Chibas Sion, but he didn't make it. He died in Warsaw. He was an ill and broken man after the close of the yeshiva.
That's why I was asking Warsaw, because on a trip to Eastern Europe, there was a Soloveitchik family buried in Warsaw.
Yes.
Next to the Netziv.
Oh, yeah.
So the Netziv was buried in Warsaw. He died in Warsaw because he had left. He had to be with all the yeshiva students, the police, and the authority. No, the authorities came and closed the Volozhin yeshiva. The exact date was, on December 22nd, 1891, the Russian Minister of Education published the regulations concerning the Volozhin yeshiva. And on January 22nd, the authorities announced the closure of the yeshiva. Now, a few years later, it was reopened, but it wasn't anything of what it was like. So the Netziv had this kind of like creative, tumultuous, fascinating life, which he devoted for 40 years, right? We said from 1854 until 1892, he was heart and soul devoted to the yeshiva and to its students. Yes?
Why couldn't it stay open if it was a private institution that was being funded privately? Why?
Russia. Because it was Russia. So it didn't matter whether it was being privately funded. This was the rule. All educational. And they had a special law just on the Volozhin yeshiva. That was the law. The law was about the Volozhin yeshiva.
Wait, were there other yeshivas in Volozhin in Lithuania?
So there were other yeshivas in Lithuania, but none of them was as prestigious as Volozhin. There were other yeshivas in other places, like, and there was a kollel. The first kollel was in Kovno, not far from Volozhin. So let's learn one, the last few minutes that we have with this whole appreciation, this introduction. It's incredibly creative and devoted leader. That's the, you get from Bialik, whether or not Bialik liked Volozhin or not, you get the love and the devotion that he had, that clearly the Netziv had for the students.
But he went off, Bialik, right?
Yeah, Bialik was not, from a Volozhin Torah learning standpoint, he probably was not the poster child. Although, think about some of the great, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who became the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chevron Slabotki Yeshiva, Rav Kook, Rav Yisus Zalman Meltzer, the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler. You're talking about essentially the greats of the greats of the late 19th century. They were from Volozhin. They were students of the Netziv. This one man single-handedly revolutionized the learning in Eastern Europe by leading and teaching in the yeshiva. We now have also shiurim. Let's say one of the interesting things about Volozhin, it wasn't like today in most yeshivas. Let's say today in yeshivas they pick mesechtos. You want to learn this topic this year, a different topic a different year. That's not how they did in Volozhin. In Volozhin, they opened to page one and they went straight. They didn't skip agaritas. They didn't skip the hard blots. They didn't skip. It was like daf yomi in depth because they were learning 16, 18 hours a day. Imagine you had 16, 18 hours a day to learn a blot.
You'd learn
it. Right. Exactly. So the Netziv has chidushim. The Netziv has comments on many of the mesechtas that no one else ever wrote on. Because in Volozhin they learned it. They learned everything from beginning to end. So let's conclude with one little piece of Torah by way of this very long, exciting introduction. And that is this week's parsha, which is why I chose it. This week's parsha is the parsha of Shmos, meaning the new sefer. So there are different names that were given to the book of Shmos. The Ramban calls it Sefer HaGeula, and other kinds of names, right? We call it Sefer Shmos, the book of names. But look on the third line. Zulas Rabbeinu Bahag. Third line, Rabbeinu Bahag. That's the halachas for gedolos. I think it was Rav Shimon Kaira, one of the gaonim, either from the 17th or 19th centuries. Actually, fascinating, part of the question of who the Bahag, when he lived, the author of the halachas gedolos, is discussed by a scholar by the name of Avraham Harkavi. The same Avraham Harkavi, the Petersburg professor, has a discussion about who was. I saw this in some other essay. I was like, oh, that's the same Avraham Harkavi from this book. Anyway, so it's authored by the Halachas Gedolos in the 8th or 9th century. And he says, these are the names. Besof, Sefer HaKadosh Yikru, Sefer Sheni. It's called a Sefer Sheni. Dekachashev Chamisha Chum Shei Torah. What are the names of the five books of the Torah according to the Halachos Gedolos, the great Halachos? Sefer Bereishis, the Chumash Sheni, and the second Chumash, the Sefer Kohanim, the book of Kohanim, the Chumash HaPekudim, and the book of the Numbers, U'Mishneh Torah. It's an interesting set of names, right? Which jumps out at you?
Sheni.
Yeah. Says the Netziv, why does he call it just the second book? I don't understand. It doesn't have an identity? It doesn't have... I don't understand. That's what he asks. So go down to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th line down. In the middle of the line, Ella Balalam Deinu, it's teaching us something. And this is why the Netziv puts it here, because it's his introduction to the whole book. Dezeha Sefer B'yichud, this Sefer specifically, Husheini L'Sefer Reishis Habriya. It's the second of the book of the beginning of creation. Kihu chelek sheni mizeha sefer. It's the second half of this book. Meaning, the Netziv is explaining to us, it's volume two. It's not that it's five books. It's really, Bereishis and Shemos, says the Netziv, are one unit. Hainu, bo nigmar seder habriya. This is the end of the story, arrangement of creation. Ukma amaram zal, the next line on the word, first one on the line I'm reading now is Bereishis, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines in. Bishvil Yisrael shenik Bereishis, for the Jewish people that are called the beginning. Pirish, therefore, meaning, Tachlis ha'olam b'chlal, the telos of the world in its entirety, hushye uma achas chelek Hashem amo. There is the purpose of the world, is that there should be one nation, at least, there's got to be one nation that is following in the ways of God as his people. And who is that? That's the Jewish people. That's part of the divine plan. V'zelo nishlam, and this wasn't finished, ad sheyatzu Yisrael mimitzrayim, until they came out of Egypt, uvo letachlisam, and they came to their tilos, shiru'uyim lios l'or goyim, la'amidam ayidias elokei olam. He says the whole point of the Jewish people is to be a light among the nations, that we should educate the whole world about godliness. So God, in the original plan of creation, was to create one nation like that to be the light on the world. Well, at the end of Sefer Bereishis, you don't have a nation, you only have a family. And they haven't received the Torah. So therefore, says the Netziv, you have to say that it's really just the second chapter of a two-chapter book. The first chapter is the beginning of the story of the Jewish people, the creation of the Jewish people, but this is the second chapter of us going down to Egypt, becoming a nation, leaving, and receiving the Torah. Go down two more lines. The first one line is V'ulam, middle of the line. Nimtza, we find, Dietzias Mitzrayim Haya Gemar Habriya, O Matan Torah, either the Exodus or the receiving of the Torah. Those were the conclusion of the creation. So therefore, he says, that's why Sefer Shemos is called Sefer Sheni. It's the story of creation. The story of creation is to create a world in which there is one people that has the wisdom of God and that shares it, that models it with others. And that's our purpose. So if you want to know why it's called Sefer Sheni and what is the story of Sefer Shemos, that's what it's all about. It's not too different. It's in a certain sense, it's part one and part two. Bereishis could be viewed, now this is my words, not the Netziv's. This could be viewed as Bereishis is like the family half, and then Sefer Shemos is the nation half. And it takes two to create. So this is just the introduction of Sefer Shemos to the Netziv's commentary we mentioned way back in the beginning of Hamek Dover. The Netziv also has a beautiful Haggadah called Imre Shefer. It's actually not such a difficult Hebrew, and I don't know if it was translated to English, but if you want, if you're looking this year for a new Haggadah that you want to take some time to study and read, the Hebrew is not so difficult, and it's very beautiful insights, the Netziv's Haggadah in the Imre Shefer. And of course, there's a lot more to say. You can take a look in the piece from Rav Zevin, in the book by Rabbi Dr. Pearl, also in the essay. There's more in the Encyclopedia Judaica, and a lot more in the biographies, but I thought this was one little glimpse into the insight of the fascinating and amazing life of this great Masmid, this great Torah scholar from the 19th century, and that was Rav Naftali Tzvi Huder Berlin, and today's Torah from the Hamek Davar.